It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farag. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal death in the developed world. We'll take a look at why maternal health care in our country has fallen behind. First, the State Assembly passed a bill that ends a moratorium on mining copper, gold, and other sulfide ores in Wisconsin. Now it's waiting for approval in the State Senate. The new bill eliminates what's called the prove-it-first requirement. Under a law passed back in the 1990s, mining companies need to prove that mining for materials like these sulfide ores wouldn't cause water pollution over a long period of time. Conservationists and tribal leaders say the new legislation puts Wisconsin's environment in danger. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She's here to share the details of the bill. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, this has passed the assembly. What have sponsors said about the need for this legislation?
Well, the sponsor in the state assembly is Representative Rob Hutton, who's from Brookfield. And as this debate has evolved in the Capitol, he's mentioned multiple times that the Wisconsin state flag has a miner on it. Some folks might remember that. And he says mining was a really important part of the state's economy for a long time, and that we should open that back up and allow mining operations to explore the possibility of being in Wisconsin again.
Let's talk about this effective moratorium and this prove-it-first requirement. What would someone have to have done under that law to establish one of these kinds of sulfide ore mines?
So the prove-it-first requirement was signed by Governor Tommy Thompson in 1998. And interestingly enough, just kind of a side factoid, Governor Scott Walker was a member of the legislature at that point and actually voted for the bill. So what that law required of mining operations was they had to prove that a similar mine in the United States or Canada had operated and been closed for 10 years without causing a certain level of pollution. And as you mentioned, the potential pollution from these mines is a major concern of opponents.
Right. We call it a moratorium very often. It wasn't technically that. It didn't say no mines ever. But I think everybody agreed this was a fairly high bar for a mining company to meet.
Right. I mean, yesterday when Representative Hutton was giving his kind of final speech before the vote on the floor, he said, you know, if the goal of the mining moratorium was just to make sure that mining was safe in Wisconsin, that there were, I think he used the phrase guardrails for pollution. He said the moratorium wasn't effective, but he said if the goal of it was to essentially end mining forever in Wisconsin, then it was effective. So his argument was that wasn't the intention of the law and that it needed to be rolled back to kind of open that opportunity up again in Wisconsin.
And through the hearing process for this legislation, have people made the case that, yeah, we have economically viable minerals of these types that companies could profitably exploit?
Absolutely. A lot of folks are pointing to northern Wisconsin, where they know the land is fertile for this sort of operation. Those sulfides, you mentioned, I think the copper, the zinc, the gold are up there. So, you know, the mines would still have to meet some environmental regulations, get some community support. So it's not a guarantee. But this basically, Representative Hutton said, opens up the process and allows people to apply for these permits from the state, makes it more possible for them.
We're talking to Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter, about mining legislation that's passed the state assembly aimed at making it easier to open certain kinds of mines here in Wisconsin. And Laurel, as we mentioned earlier, environmentalists and tribal organizations are worried about this legislation. What have they said about it?
Well, essentially what happens in sulfide mining that causes that pollution is that when rocks containing sulfide are exposed to air and water, they can cause acid drainage. And so a lot of people are worried that that acid drainage would seep over into nearby water supplies and have a really detrimental effect on the area surrounding the mine and the groundwater. And they've argued that in addition to just those environmental concerns, you know, preserving the state's natural resources, they say compromising that land also could hurt the state's tourism industry. People aren't going to be interested in, you know, river rafting or hiking, camping, picnicking. There was some talk yesterday during the debate about, you know, picnicking at mining sites. Those are the primary arguments of opponents to the bill.
I understand that the Assembly added amendments in part to reach out to Senate Republicans who might have potentially not voted for the legislation. What kind of things changed in the amendment process?
That's right. So there were a handful early this week, of Senate Republicans who said they just weren't entirely sure about the bill yet. A lot of people are voicing those concerns about pollution in the environment, and they want to make sure that certain protections are in place. So last night, the Assembly added five different amendments, new amendments to the bill, and those are aimed at doing a couple of things. So one would delay the start time of the bill when it would become law, and that's intended to give local governments a little bit more time to evaluate their own mining ordinances. So local governments would be prepared if a mining organization wanted to apply for a permit in their area. Another amendment would also put protections in place that would keep mining operations from doing some kind of complicated profit shifting that would allow them to avoid some state taxes on their profits. And another thing clarifies the definition of what's called bulk sampling. So when a mining operation comes in and samples the land, the legislation now specifies how much they can take for that sampling process.
What is the role of the DNR under this new legislation? How much authority would they have over potential mines?
Well, that's a primary argument of supporters of this bill. They say we're not doing anything to change the DNR's oversight or the standards that are in place. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, when he was speaking with reporters before the session yesterday, he said, you know, we have some of the, I think he said, most stringent processes in the country. So a lot of people are pointing to the DNR's permitting process for these mines and saying, it's good, we care about the environment. If anybody is going to have sulfide mines in the United States, because we're using these minerals in our daily lives, Wisconsin should be the place to do it because we'll do it responsibly.
I want to look at kinds of mining that are not affected by this. We have the frac sand mines in western Wisconsin mostly. There was that proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin that didn't end up happening. Those were not affected by this moratorium, this prove it first rule, right?
That's right. This is just for sulfide mining.
Now, it's passed the Assembly. We've talked a little about the Senate and amendments made to appeal to key senators. What are the prospects? What's the timeline for this going through the Senate?
Well, we reached out to the spokesman for Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald yesterday, and he said the Senate is aiming to take it up next week, specifically on Tuesday, when they're on the floor. And Representative Rob Hutton told the press corps yesterday that he's confident that the bill will pass the Senate because of those five amendments that they added last night.
There were concerns raised by some Senate Republicans or indications that they weren't necessarily on board before those amendments. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. And Representative Hutton and Speaker Voss were, I think, in active negotiations, possibly into the evening last night with some of those senators. I know that Senator Jerry Petrowski, Robert Coles, and Luther Olson were all among the senators who had kind of voiced some concerns and got those changes in. And this way, it goes to the Senate, in theory, passes the Senate, and it wouldn't have to go back to the Assembly to be approved if senators wanted to add changes.
We'll leave it there. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rob.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter. She joined us to look at a bill that passed in the state assembly. The legislation ends an effective moratorium on mining certain materials in Wisconsin, things like copper, gold, and other sulfide ores. Coming up, learn about the current state of maternal health care in the United States. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, learn about some simple seasonal cooking on this edition of Food Friday. Right now, the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal deaths in the developed world, and 60% of these deaths are preventable, and some data suggest these rates are on the rise. That's the subject of a new series from ProPublica and NPR. Robin Fields is managing editor of ProPublica. You can find her article on this on the Central Time Facebook page. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I know it's kind of hard to tell. The numbers are difficult to find, and we'll get into that in a minute. But from what we can tell, how do we in the United States compare to other developed countries when it comes to death related to pregnancy and childbirth? I'm going to cut in there, Robin. We just got some serious distortion on your phone line as you started to answer that question there. We'll have our producer pick up Robin Fields from ProPublica as we look at data and the sometimes confusing data when it comes to deaths related to pregnancy and childbirth in the United States. A new report from ProPublica and NPR looks at the impact of these complications, these deaths, and how hard it is to track this kind of data. We'll get Robin back on the line. I think we have her now. Robin, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, let's give it another shot. What do we know? How do we compare to other countries?
Not very well from all the estimates that we're aware of. The best CDC numbers have our maternal mortality rate at about 17 per 100,000 live births. That would be a lot higher than countries like the UK or France or Germany.
And I was looking at overall causes of death in the United States, and when you look at women in childbearing age ranges, upper teens to 30s, it's in the top 10. This is a serious problem in the United States.
The raw numbers of deaths, they think, are 700 to 900 a year. And as you said leading into this, a lot of those deaths are believed to be preventable. So, that's, I think, not the kinds of numbers that the experts would want us to have.
The surprising thing to me wasn't just the numbers, but how little we know and how bad a job we do in this country and state by state at tracking or even agreeing on what we're tracking. Can you talk about some of the problems you ran into as you started to try to figure this out?
Well, I think that certainly through the 90s, we had a real undercount of maternal deaths because all of our information relied almost entirely on death certificates, and death certificates at that time, for the most part, did not have any specific question about whether the decedent had been pregnant at the time of death or within a year of dying. We've since added a checkbox to our death certificates to try to capture some of the deaths that we were missing. But that has led to overcounting, sort of the opposite problem in some circumstances. So it hasn't been easy for us to find our way to accurate counts and an accurate maternal mortality rate. And in part, I think the reliance on death certificates, a lot of the experts seem to point to that and point to other countries where in-depth case review is used to try to get to sort of beyond that and to a more comprehensive understanding of what happened.
I didn't know, but it appears that having just gone through childbirth can make certain kinds of heart conditions, heart attacks, more likely. And so it sounds likely that some women who might have died, it might have been reported as cardiac arrest or heart failure, and we never would have seen that link to pregnancy at all. Is that right?
Yes, I think that it can be very difficult to always see the link. A doctor at the CDC was saying that pregnancy makes you more likely to have embolisms, too. And if you had an embolism and it turned out to be fatal a week after giving birth, the person who filled out your death certificate might not make that link to your pregnancy.
And the urgency of having this kind of data, again, coming to that back to this point, a lot of these deaths would be preventable, I guess, if the medical community knew what they were looking for. Can you talk about how some states have tried to track this better so they can treat it better?
I think the most notable success story in that regard is probably California. California has a very robust maternal mortality review committee process, and they've used that process and looking in depth into deaths to try to glean what can be learned to turn into help for prevention. They've put together safety bundles and toolkits that all kinds of health facilities can adopt so that they can standardize best practices.
I got a sense from the experts that you talked to in your article that there's a sense of a frustration in the country that we know women are dying at higher rates in other countries, and there doesn't seem to be, or there hadn't been, a sense of urgency about tracking this data and doing something about that. What were you hearing from people?
I think that what we heard a lot was this is not the toughest problem to solve. It's very possible to solve this, only 700, 900 cases a year. We collect far more sophisticated data successfully about all sorts of areas of healthcare. They felt strongly that it's embarrassing that we don't have a reliable, official, published maternal mortality rate and haven't for a decade. And they felt like this reflected the lack of priority that this has.
And for a lot of the funding for this kind of research, very little of it, it sounds like, comes from the federal government. A lot of it is private foundations or pharmaceutical companies.
Yes, probably the most notable national initiative is funded by Merck for Mothers, which is a charitable initiative.
We are talking about maternal deaths in the United States, higher rates than other developed countries, vague data, not a lot of great data collection here. Robin Fields is with us from ProPublica. She's been working on this series that ProPublica has been doing called Lost Mothers. Talk about some more of the focus of the series. Part of it is heartbreaking. Actually, you went out and were finding individual stories of the people who had died before, during, and after pregnancy. How did you track them down?
I think one of the main ways we've tracked them down is using social media to ask people to tell us about their loved ones. It's sort of strange, but when women die this way, they're often it doesn't appear in their obituaries. People don't like to talk about it publicly, and it makes them sort of invisible. We're trying to sort of get a complete picture of what happened in the year 2016 by trying to identify as many of the women who died that year as we can, as their loved ones will, you know, allow us to try to make them visible finally.
We heard from Mike in Milwaukee. Mike is wondering, how does maternal mortality rate break down based on race? Is that something we know from the data we have?
What we know from the data that we have is that the death rate for African American women is considerably higher than that for white women or Hispanic women, and that there is quite a racial disparity.
And how about things like education level and income level? Are there disparities along those lines as well?
The disparities along those lines, interestingly, are far more modest.
And looking at the individual stories, while there may be tendencies, this seems like it's someone that's happening to some extent in all walks of life.
That was one of the amazing things that it comes out in the story that we did that was actually called Lost Mothers, where we talked about case after case after case, is that it wasn't so simple to sort of figure out who these women were. They were from very different backgrounds, very different socioeconomic situations. Many of them were professionals. I think that probably a lot of people assume this is, you know, much more typical for older mothers. That's not always the case at all. It's certainly the rates for higher for older mothers, but I think it defies stereotyping.
And again, the data is unclear, but some ways of reading it suggest that we're getting worse. Maternal mortality rates have risen in the United States. Again, potentially, why would that be?
I think that the whys of that are a little probably not as well understood. But that it's happening is pretty much agreed on by the people who are most expert in this area. Even if you account for a certain amount of noise in the data that might have inflated the rate of the rise, I think most people think that we certainly have been at least going upward over the last 20 to 25 years, which is unusual. I mean, it's not what you would expect.
What kind of response have you gotten to this series? Do you have people maybe in the healthcare professions, maybe in families coming out and saying, yes, thank you, somebody's finally paying attention to this?
We've really gotten an astonishing response to these stories because I think that this is not a case where we're exposing something that is in a, you know, completely unknown. It's certainly well known to people who are in this field. But I think doing the kinds of stories that we've done, people have said to us, I have never seen my story told. And I think we're getting a lot of that. And I think that I think the nicest thing that we've heard probably is that a lot of people have felt that it's empowering and perhaps is drawing some, you know, momentum and attention to this that it's lacked for a long time.
And with that momentum, you mentioned the story in California. In the article, you read that the UK is considered in some ways a gold standard in terms of tracking this kind of data. Is there momentum now to take what people are doing right in some places and figure out how to get that everywhere else?
I think that there is a more concerted effort to do that. Certainly, the tool that we write about in the story that I just did, that's called Maria, is an effort to pool and standardize data and to learn from places that are doing better.
And what's your next focus as you continue to look at this issue?
I think as we've sort of put out there on social media and trying to hear from people, we're quite interested in this issue of racial disparities that your listener brought up, and I think that there's a lot more to be said about that.
We'll leave it there for now. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Again, thanks for having me.
That's Robin Fields, managing editor at ProPublica. We've been talking about the state of maternal health care in the United States. We have a link to her and her colleagues' reporting on this issue. You can find it on our Facebook page. First, has this ever happened to you? You've got a recipe you want to make. There's a key ingredient, maybe a vegetable. You head to the store to pick some up. And it doesn't look good. It's out of season. It costs three times what you expected. It's not appetizing. Our next guest has an answer. Flip things around. Find the stuff that looks good at the market now, and then build your meal around it. We're learning about ingredient-inspired cooking on this edition of Food Friday. Chef David Tanis says we should embrace the idea of market cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What seasonal ingredients are inspiring your cooking right now? What kind of things do you look forward to around the year when they're in season to cook with? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Tanis is a chef. He's the author of David Tanis Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations Ingredient by Ingredient. His other books include A Platter of Figs and One Good Dish. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for asking.
Well, what do you mean when you say market cooking?
Well, what I mean is go to the market, see what looks good, take it home, cook it. It's... It's a sort of an age-old process that somehow we forgot about it.
Right.
It makes sense. It makes sense, and it's also, I mean, it's a nice experience, too.
Right. I think a lot of times, like I said at the outset, we've got that recipe we might want to make, and we lock in on that before we go to the store. How do we start to get ourselves back in that mindset to hunt and gather the stuff that looks good on the produce shelves?
Hey, I don't know. Head down to the farmer's market. That's the place you're going to probably find the very freshest stuff. And barring a farmer's market in your vicinity, then head to the store that sells the best looking produce.
And you've broken it down in your cookbook, ingredient by ingredient, to build it around, you know, everything from garlic to eggplant. So is that how you kind of start with your cooking? You say, I've got a lot of really great garlic. What am I going to do with it today?
Well, you know, that's the way, you know, an old farmstead would work. And that's actually the way restaurants work too. It's like, you look at your supply and say, got a lot of this. I think we'll be running that for a few days. I mean, it's like people expect to eat something different every day, but sometimes it's nice to eat fennel 3 days in a row, you know, in different guises. But,
And a lot of times I think we build our cooking around the protein, you know, the meat or the tofu or whatever it's going to be. Your cookbook, you really build it for the most part around the vegetables. That doesn't mean meat doesn't show up, but it's not really the feature. Why do you like to feature the vegetable produce in your cooking?
Well, I think the vegetables are the most interesting part of any meal, really. And so, I mean, a little meat is nice, but it's not, you know, it's not absolutely essential. And vegetables are much more interesting, really. I mean, there's so many different kinds of vegetables as well. And the whole sort of routine of waiting for the vegetable that you adore to come back into season is really kind of a thrill when the asparagus gets to the market in the spring. So that's another aspect. In the book, every vegetable, and certainly it's not encyclopedic, but every vegetable has a little chapter of its own. So you'll find several cauliflower recipes in the cauliflower chapter. And well, when you get to the potato chapter, you'll find a number more recipes somehow. Sort of a potato fan, aren't you?
Who's not a potato fan? Well, you mentioned cauliflower, and actually that's one of the recipes you shared with us. And this is something I'm still seeing local cauliflower on the shelves. My cauliflower in my garden didn't do well. I think I see one floret finally popping up. But you have a recipe that we've posted on our website, seared cauliflower with anchovy, lemon, and capers. Can you tell us about this recipe?
Yeah, it's just, well, of course, every recipe in the book is pretty simple because I didn't want to make complicated recipes. I wanted a very user-friendly cookbook. But this is a great way to cook cauliflower, which I didn't invent. But you slice the cauliflower in sort of thick-ish, you know, sort of quarter to half-inch thick slices rather than break it into florets. And then you sear it on, you know, in a cast iron pan or on a griddle and get it quite brown. You could even cook it over coals if your coal grate was, if your grate was fine enough. But what happens then is you're browning both sides of the cauliflower. That just adds, concentrates the sweetness. It gives that little roasty, toasty edge to it. And already that's good. But then if you spoon a little sauce that's made with, olive oil and lemon and chopped capers and a little bit of anchovy, spoon that over the sweet seared cauliflower, well, that's dinner. That's delicious.
I was going to say, do you put that down as a side dish, or is this kind of the feature of a dinner?
Hey, I mean, it depends on how much you like cauliflower. It could be a first course. It could go alongside, the roast chicken. It could be, I don't know. It could be any of those things. Could be breakfast too, if you have a mind for a savory breakfast.
We're talking to David Tanis. His new book is David Tanis Market Cooking. He says, don't start with the recipe. Start with the ingredients that are looking great this time of year. Then find a recipe that uses them to their best ability. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Bird is on the line in Perry. Bird, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, you've been talking about vegetables. And I think people don't always realize that meat can be seasonal as well. Are you still there?
Yep. What meat are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, I'm a shepherd. I raise lamb in Dane County, and sheep are seasonal breeders. So lamb is typically harvested and available in the fall this time of year. So there's a lot of pressure from the commercial sheep industry to get sheep to breed out of season. That's even the way it's referred to.
Bird, thanks a lot for the call. David, I hadn't thought about that. I go to the butcher counter and I see what's there, and I don't think of meat as being seasonal. Is that something you watch for yourself, though?
Well, certainly lamb is seasonal, and if you can get the spring lamb, it's awfully delicious. But it's true that the bigger lamb industry has urged lamb ranchers to make their lambs their sheep bare all year round. So you don't notice the seasonality so much anymore of sheep or lamb. But, you know, fish, there are fish seasons as well. You know, salmon is the best, the wild salmon is the best in the spring. And so you always wait for that to come in.
Is it more, you mentioned the joy of waiting for the thing you like to come back in the season, like asparagus in the spring. I mean, is it just more fun to cook and eat this way?
Well, it's more, I don't know whether it's more, if it's fun for me, but I'll tell you, you get better tasting asparagus that way, mm-hmm. right? If your asparagus was just picked and brought to market, it tastes really super sweet. But if it came all the way from I don't know where, it's apt to just look nice but not necessarily taste nice.
I want to go back to garlic. That's where you start your book, and you say it's one of your favorites. I think a lot of people's favorites. And you've got just a lot of creative ways to use it, including garlic chips that you might sprinkle on another dish. How do we make these garlic chips?
It's super simple. You just slice the garlic cloves thinly, and heat some oil. So it's sort of shallow fried in about an inch of oil. And you toss them in and just let them get barely golden. And then out they come and they get a little bit of salt. You could put it on lots of things. I learned about it in Mexico years ago. There was a little fish. You could get a fried fish al mojo de ajo, and that just meant with the slivered toasted garlic slices sprinkled all over it. But it's good in a green salad, too.
I could see it being really good on potatoes. I mean, what wouldn't it be good on, I guess, except maybe dessert? But it seems really versatile.
Yeah, even then, you know, salted caramel ice cream with garlic chips, let's try it.
Okay.
At least once.
I'm on board. We're talking to Chef David Tanis right now, talking about market cooking, ingredient-inspired, simple cooking. You can join in now at 800-642-1234 with your ideas, with your questions for David. Where do you look to for your inspiration in cooking? Do you like to just go and see what looks good at the store, the farmer's market, your garden, your fridge for that matter, and then build a recipe around that? Do you have some produce staring you in the face at the store these days? You want to cook with it, you don't know what to do? Well, David might be able to give you some ideas. Call in now. Let us know some of your favorite fall ingredients. Any squash fans, cauliflower, the beets? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find links to a couple recipes from David on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're continuing our discussion about simple ingredient-inspired cooking with Chef David Tanis. He's the author of the new book, David Tanis Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What are the seasonal ingredients that you're cooking with here in Wisconsin, maybe even this weekend? Do you have some produce? Have you seen something at the store you'd like to try? You don't know what to do with it? David can probably help you out. You can call in with your questions. And what season do you look forward to for cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go back to our callers now. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you want to bring up, John?
Well, I'm calling kind of agreeing with your guest 100%, but also with the previous caller. I'm a hunter. So right now, duck, pheasant, goose is in season, grouse, you know, any kind of small game fishing is still in season. Pretty soon, deer season will be coming up. And that, along with all the seasonal vegetables that your guest is talking about, that is exactly the way to live.
And John, awesome. Do you have a favorite from that list?
Duck is very good. I like venison. I eat it all. Anything I hunt, I eat.
All right, John, thanks a lot for that
dinner,
call.
Please. I'd love to come to your house for dinner.
And Robin, I'll throw into the mix there. I mean, foraging is big in Wisconsin in spring. People look forward to the morel mushroom. So it's not just the grown and harvested stuff. It's the hunted and foraged things. Do you have any favorites, Robin, from that world? I mean, I'm sorry, David, from that world.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, If you can find somebody to go mushroom hunting with, you're in for thrills, I think. Well, I mean, when you, I know how to identify three or four kinds myself, but I usually try to go with somebody who knows a little more than I do. But when you come across a little clearing and a clump of fresh porcini are just waiting there for you, well, it's like the best kind of shopping experience. But all sorts of wild mushrooms are, I'm a big fan.
And David, you gave us another recipe as well for fennel, fennel al forno. And fennel is one of those things I get from our CSA, and I got to say it usually ends up in the compost. I don't know what the heck to do with fennel. Can you give us some fennel basics? We've got that this time of year, and then talk about that recipe.
There are so many things to do with fennel. I mean, the simplest thing to do really is to slice it thin and dress it with olive oil, lemon, and salt. Boom. And it's the best thing you ever had.
And that's raw, not cooked?
Yes, just it's a slivered raw fennel salad. If you have a little mandolin at home, you could use that. But if you don't, you could just slice it thinly with a knife. It's made, you make it in about 2 minutes. And it's the best thing you ever ate. But if you want something more complex, then more of a meal, I guess. I have a recipe for fennel in the oven. That's al forno. where the fennel is blanched, cut into quarters, and sort of smothered a little with mozzarella and parmesan, and baked. It's awfully nice, because it's all bubbly on the top and with that delicious cheese, and then you have that sweet sort of anise-flavored fennel soft. I mean, we have to eat it with a knife and fork, but it's quite delicious.
We're talking to David Tanis on this edition of Food Friday. He's giving us some inspiration on how to make the best of seasonal ingredients, the good-looking stuff at the farmer's market, on the store shelves, in our gardens. His new book is David Tanis Market Cooking. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for David, your thoughts, and maybe your favorite seasonal ingredient, whether it's the season that we're in right now, autumn here in Wisconsin, or other times of year. 800-642-1234. David, I've got a lot of winter squash now, which is one of the things I look forward to every year. I do a lot of things with it, but I'd love to be more creative. Any suggestions on what we can do with our winter squash?
Oh yeah. What kind do you grow?
Whatever my CSA brings me. I've tried and failed to grow. I'm not a very good gardener. I should say that up front.
And then they stack up. So yeah, there's lots of great things to do besides soup. But soup is a good thing as well. I've been doing this thing with making slices, not paper thin slices, but more sort of half inch thick slices and roasting them. Then making a brown butter sauce to spoon over them. I mean, it's really very quickly made in the pan. It's just basically foamy. When the butter starts to smell nutty and it's not black, it's more like brunette, or even sort of just approaching brunette. Then you spoon it over the roasted butternut squash slices, and shaved parmesan all over the top. Now, almost anything would taste good that way, but it's very good with squash.
And that's just straight up butter? There's nothing sweet in that sauce?
No, not at all.
Oh, good. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, there's another recipe for squash steamed with sake and meat, and well, it's a sort of Japanese style squash with miso and sake, and eaten as a little salad. It's quite delicious.
Now, I've got some vegetables on my list that I like, but I have a hard time getting other people close to me and my family to eat. The chard, the beets, things like that. Any ideas on how to take those vegetables that aren't always crowd pleasers and I don't know, either disguise them or bring out their flavor in a way that people appreciate?
Well, the chard is completely delicious. I don't know what the
I don't know what to tell you, man.
All right. Well,
I think tastes like dirt. That's the common theme for beets and chard I hear sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you can find some in this book, but the
David,
try this. Just bring a pot of water. Yes.
Oop, you're cutting in and out a little bit, David. I'm sorry. Yeah. I think we got you now. Go for it.
I was just going to say, for the easiest chard dish, take your big chard leaves, well, you take the stems off, drop them in boiling water for a minute, take them out, and just chop them roughly. Then you heat a little oil in the pan, add some garlic, and a little bit of crushed red pepper flakes. Add the chard, salt and pepper, you're good to go. It takes about 2 minutes, but it makes the chard really taste delicious.
That sounds really good. And this brings me back to a theme you mentioned earlier, trying to keep this simple. You're really featuring the flavors of the vegetables, not kind of disguising them amidst a bunch of other stuff.
Well, yeah, it's uncomplicated, but sometimes the simplest food is the best food, I find. I have an Italian friend, and we sort of argue whether or not. She says, we say, oh, three or four ingredients, it's enough. And she says, no, I think maybe three is already enough. So.
And David, yeah. What are you enjoying cooking with this time of year?
It's kind of a great time of year for cooking. And apples are, the new crop apples, I think, are just absolutely wonderful. And it is the time of year when you're excited about pumpkins and squash, but mushrooms too, a lot of mushrooms. And I tasted something just the other day in Los Angeles that I thought was awfully good, made with beets, by the way. I'm going to try to get that recipe. It was at a little restaurant in Silver Lake called Botanica, and they make a grated beet muhammara. Which muhammara is a Middle Eastern sauce that's usually made with roasted peppers and walnuts and olive oil and garlic, sort of a spicy schmear. And they just replaced the peppers with beets. I have to tell you, it's the best thing you ever ate.
That sounds fantastic, and that's a good place to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
That's David Tanis. He's a chef. He's the author of the new cookbook we've been talking about. It's David Tanis Market Cooking, Recipes and Revelations, Ingredient by Ingredient. His other books include A Platter of Figs and One Good Dish. You can find a couple of the recipes we've been talking about linked on the Ideas Network Facebook page or over at WPR.org. Check out those recipes for seared cauliflower with anchovy, lemon, and capers, and fennel al forno, which it sounds like just means fennel in the oven. It's time to change the time this weekend, Saturday night. Okay, technically Sunday morning, we turn our clocks back an hour as daylight savings time comes to an end. We'll get that extra hour of sleep or whatever you want to do with it, but not everyone is happy, including producer Jay Carlisle Larson. Hey, JC.
Hi, Rob.
You are not a fan of the principle of daylight savings time.
I am not. I spent my formative years in both Nevada and in Indiana where we didn't really have to worry about daylight saving time. And I never had to change the clock, got really comfortable in my daily existence, not having to worry about it. And then in college, that's when Indiana decided that it was time, and it threw everyone on campus off. No one knew what to do, and it pretty much ruined about 2 weeks.
Do you still find it disorienting?
Oh, of course. How could you not?
You don't appreciate the extra hour we're going to get this weekend?
Well, of course I appreciate that, but I don't like that I lost the hour back in the spring.
See, I enjoy that because I accuse various people around that time of year of stealing that hour from everyone. It's a kind of a fun blame game.
Sure, yeah, but it doesn't always work out for you, Rob.
Now, have you made a plan for what to do with this extra hour?
I'm just going to sleep.
Just sleep.
Just sleep. I'm not going to do anything more exciting than that.
All right. I might read a little extra and then sleep.
Oh, well,
I don't
look
know.
At you,
I always
hero.
Manage a way to. I always manage a way to fidget
to
that
find,
hour away.
Yeah.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.